The Foodies in the Field podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was made, the Turrbal and Noongar people of Meanjin, as well as the lands from where you may be listening from today. We pay respects to elders both past and present and acknowledge that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were the first foodies of this nation, where food systems, knowledge and food practices have always been deeply embedded in this country, long before colonisation. Hi. Welcome to Public Health Nutrition from Foodies in the Field, a podcast showcasing stories from passionate foodies about who they are and what they do. I'm Sophie Wright-Pedersen, your podcast host, and on today's show we have part two of my interview with Associate Professor Helen Vigen from the Queensland University of Technology. This episode is all about Helen's food literacy work and the global impact that it's had. If you're unsure about what food literacy is, why we should be considering it as part of our everyday practice, and how we can do this, then this is the episode for you. Okay, we'll get on to your food literacy stuff. Obviously, in 2013, you said you were working for QUT, but when did you start your PhD?
So I started my PhD because the department had done a midpoint review of Eat Well Queensland, and people had said we weren't doing enough in food literacy, and that term didn't exist at the time. And because I had a background in home ec, and I was the only one in the team with a background in home ec, my boss at the time said, well, Helen, go and find a program somewhere so that we can say we're doing something. And I said, oh, I think there's a few steps missing there. It seems to mean something different to everybody, and we don't even know if it has a relationship to food intake. And so I kind of kept whinging about that. And so at the time, our internal health promotion agency was Health Promotion Queensland. And as a staff member, like, you could put forward bids for what their tender rounds would be. And so we prepared a bid to say that we wanted to look at food literacy, and they changed it to saying we wanted to look at interventions for food literacy with young people, and the bid got up, and then I left the department because I said, oh, look, I want to do that, and there'll be a conflict of interest, obviously, if I stay here. So I approached Danielle Galagos and said, I'll write the grant.
So wait, were you applying for the grant to your ex-workplace for you to explore what food literacy actually could be defined as?
Yeah, so the grant.
But that's why you left that job, was because you couldn't apply for that grant if you.
Yeah, well, and also because I thought if I'm going to, I looked at the scholarships, and the scholarships came nowhere close to what I was earning.
Yeah, yeah, obviously.
And I knew I could write a grant, and I thought, I want to do something that's actually going to be used. So then the tricky part was, I'm getting paid for the grant, but I'm also doing a PhD. So what's my IP and what's not? So the grant deliverable was to identify best buyers for the department in food literacy for young people experiencing disadvantage. And my thesis developed a definition for food literacy and modelled its relationship to food intake. But I used young people experiencing disadvantage to do that.
Interesting. So that's where it all came from.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so, food literacy, I'd heard of health literacy. Yeah. Like when I came to QUT and knew you and then started going, oh, there's this term food literacy. What do you mean by food literacy? Because I think it's still a term. Unless you've read like your paper, for example, you might not actually.
Who wouldn't have read my paper? I didn't embark on the research thinking we would stick with the term. So I sort of embarked on it because I thought, I think what practitioners are getting at when they've said that in the midpoint review is this point of where the rubber hits the road of how do I actually enact working out how I feed myself from whatever it is that I have around me. And I could see already from the rhetoric of what people were saying we needed to teach people to do, that it was very deficit based. And it kind of made a whole lot of assumptions of things that people maybe needed to do, you know, like people should know how to grow their own food. They should know where, the transport route this thing took before, and all of that stuff's interesting. But I thought, I don't think that that's what people are doing in their day-to-dayness of their lives. You know, I was asked explicitly to look at young people experiencing disadvantage. And at the time, I thought, and I don't think people experiencing disadvantage can't do this stuff. So I wanted to make sure. I thought, I want to create this agenda. And also I thought, even from like from my own life, I grew up in a migrant household, and I had never thought of my parents as having experienced disadvantage before. But, you know, part of my thesis was critiquing different ways of defining and conceptualizing disadvantage, and they were disadvantaged in every single possible marker, you know, education, employment, income, housing, every single marker. You would put them in the highest quintile of disadvantage, and they are the origin of my food literacy. And it was always it was that disadvantage that they were so proud of. You know, it's Italian cuisine, and a lot of cuisines around the world come from, this is what we did because we only had this and this. And that really resonated with my experience of talking to people in hospitals or in other places, is that they don't talk to you about the fact that they could do this killer souffle. They talk to you about the fact that there was only this and this and this left, and I did this with it, or I had this person with this dietary restriction and this person with this dietary restriction, and I only had a kettle and I did this. Like, people do remarkable things, but there's a limit to that. You know, the social determinants of health limit the extent to which that can be achieved. So I guess I wanted to use a process where people were at the center of it rather than experts, in terms of determining what were the knowledge and skills and behaviors that you, over your life course, considered you needed to know and understand about food to use it to meet your needs. And then how did you think that that modeled to what you ate? How did you think that influenced what you ate?
And so that's how you came to the definition of what food literacy is. Yeah. So with food literacy, is it, because I think when I first heard it, I thought it's just that you have the knowledge and skills that you need to cook, prepare, choose, eat food. But from what you've described, it's kind of how you implement those knowledge and skills.
Yeah, look, I think there's so many different words and terms now. And now the research has moved on to measurement, and that's kind of a whole different minefield. But my thesis and what drew me to the research in the first place was this part of the food system that we represent in food system diagrams as either consumer behaviors or whatever, like, but we don't really kind of tease them out in terms of what they are. And we need to kind of know that, because we want to be able to describe the relative influence of those things relative to other things that are going on in the food system. So I've described it as the knowledge, skills, and behaviors to protect diet quality through change and strengthen dietary resilience over time. And then I've identified 11 components that fall under planning and management, selection, preparation, and eating that now we've developed measures for. But those 11 components are fairly obvious kind of things. So the planning and management are like prioritizing time and money for food, and being able to identify the resources that you've got available to you, and then be able to make feasible decisions within those resources, so that if something changes, you're still going to get the outcome that you want within the time that you've got it. Then in the selection part, it's a bit around knowing your food environment and what's in it. So having some familiarity with that, knowing the pros and cons of the different places that you can obtain food from in your food environment, and then being able to judge the quality of food. And by that, it's just that you would have a fairly predictable outcome from whatever selection that you made. And that's from, like, people think of that typically, people's default is always their groceries and the foods that they might prepare, but including prepared foods in that. So how do you balance those things, eating out and all of that?
When you're talking about quality, are you talking about nutritional quality or like all types of quality?
Yeah, whatever, however, whatever quality means to you. So it's hard to get questions on validated questions on these things because it, so like if I'm choosing this apple and I think I've picked a crispy one, I probably have picked a crispy one. Or if I buy this bit of takeaway, it's as greasy as I probably think it is. That's the quality is not going to be overly different to like my, I've got these skills in being able to judge the quality of what that might be like. Obviously, you're not going to, that's not going to happen all of the time. And then the planning, the preparation one was really interesting because we had all of these things around particular, like originally, because the first study I did was asking experts from a range of different disciplines what they thought the essential knowledge and skills were. Then we reviewed, we created a model from that. Then we reviewed a whole lot of existing interventions to see how that rang true. And then we talked to young people across the spectrum of disadvantage, from young people experiencing homelessness. So Red Cross was a partner there. Then Edmund Rice was a partner in young people who'd kind of come out of a period of disadvantage, like juvenile detention or homelessness or something like that, and were just re-engaging with an institution, in this case their education. But typically they were transitioning to stable housing. And then next along were people that were disadvantaged purely by their CEFA scores, and then QUT business graduates as the other end of that spectrum.
Oh, wow.
Sort of and asked them how, like we did life course interviewing, so household they were living in now and their housing situation and how they went about feeding themselves, and then the last one before that and the one before that and the one before that, and kind of were picking through how they go about feeding themselves, how they'd acquired that over time, why they thought those, you know, how in that conversation, why those things were important. And then when they thought of somebody who was good with food, and I literally use that term, well, what is it that they can do? And who is that person, you know, like who's that person to you? And even that was interesting because, you know, everybody thinks it's going to be somebody on TV or something, but it was always someone in there, one of those households that they lived
interesting.
In.
And with all of those like components of food literacy, you've gone along this spectrum of disadvantage. Did you find that it was different between?
Yeah. So in the qualitative analysis, what I was looking for were, what is this knowledge, skill or behavior that is present in all of those people? And it's presenting, it would present in a different way, but it was still the same behavior. So just say the one around balancing up your resources in the planning and management. So, you know, the people experiencing homelessness would talk about the what they would do with the, like how they would time how they ate and what they would do depending on which, like I interviewed them at the Red Cross Night Cafe. It opened on two nights a week, but there were other things that opened on other nights a week that had other different kinds of food. So how they kind of manage that resource, if you like, whereas the QT graduate was talking about, I work late on these three nights, I go to gym here, the supermarket's open at this time, but it's not open at that time. So if I don't plan ahead and go shopping at these times, I'm going to end up, I find that I end up eating takeaway. And like I say, and then the in-between person, like so the one, a girl from Edmund Rice, so she, one of the ones for the planning and management was this lady who had gotten pregnant at 16 and mum kicked her out. So she was living with her boyfriend that was the father and one of his mates, and she was the only one earning anything because she was getting a single mother pension, and the other two, I don't think they were Australian citizens and they were underage. And so she said when she first moved in, she thought, I got this. And she did grocery shopping and she thought, I'm going to have a roast and I'm, you know, I'm going to be this perfect, you know. And she says in the quote, and then that never happened and I ended up eating 2-minute noodles at 8 o'clock at night. And it's this perfect thing where she says, I've always got some chicken tonight or a jar of something. I've always got some frozen veg and I've always got a little bit of meat in the freezer and one of those packet rice things. So I know that's how I organize my shopping now. And I don't know how you measure that, because, you know, like if you're measuring that person, you would want them on the roast day. you wouldn't want them on the chicken tonight day, but she can do the chicken tonight every day. And she can only do the roast probably once a month, and it'll be 2 minute noodles on the other nights. So it's was sort of, you know, that process that people go through to go, these are my resources, let me spend some time thinking about how I'm going to pull them together. And I wanted to give, we've been thinking about this, it's really now that we've developed a measure, we're kind of at this next kind of stage of that was just the holy grail for so long. I think really, because I've been trying to get back in touch with what I was trying to achieve here, because I think food literacy has got a huge potential for it to be, these are things that people don't know how to do, and if they had this information, that's the problem. Like, they don't know how to do these things, and it's just another set of things that we can tell people they don't know how to do. And that wasn't my intention at all. I mean, my very reason for leaving the government to do this work was because I wanted people's voice to direct what these things were that people should be able to do. And I think why that was important is that because I think a lot of the time when you're in conversations with public health researchers who are looking at the price of food or food environments, they think this part seems very old-fashioned and very...
Well, individualistic.
Yeah, but I think it's because people do some pretty remarkable things and they're not all the same in their circumstances. And I think that when you think of it only as food environments, because we all know that that is a game changer, the food environment, that's incredibly significant. You know, we started this conversation talking about, you know, that Tim Tams are always on special on the corner and I can't walk anywhere because there's too many dogs. Like the whole reason I work in public health nutrition is that it's those bigger factors that are the bigger determinants of the way that you eat. But you want to give some visibility. Like, they're invisible at the moment in our consideration of how the food system impacts on how an individual eats. And I was even, just to circle all the way back around to our conversations around gender, I thought, well, I wonder if that's because it's such gendered, unpaid, everyday routine work that it seems like it doesn't have this visibility. I was thinking about International Women's Day and, you know, we were talking about the dietetic profession and the nutrition profession and it being female dominated. But we know that even as food roles are changing and they're becoming less gendered around the world, the contribution of women to nutritional status, but food traditions, forming social connections with food, food and culture, and people's food literacy. I mean, that's phenomenal. And I think really I wanted to give that a name so that it had, it was in the mix as something we considered.
And I think just as you've been talking, there's so many things that kind of come up there, but maybe it's not so much about if people have the knowledge or skills or behaviors or, and like that's maybe not our aim is saying you have, because I guess that's where you started was like people don't need to know how to make a souffle. Like that's not a marker of whether or not they're food literate. That's a marker of if they're a specific type of food literate that they got taught with those resources and have that kind of accessibility to even getting to that point. But it's about maybe teaching them the process of understanding how to become food literate.
Yeah, look, I think too, like I wanted to really position where disadvantage sat in all of this as well. You know, the model then that I looked at, how does then food literacy relate to food intake, was that it made meeting guidelines, whatever they were, whether they were about food security or nutrition, it made the outcome more predictable. So you had more certainty, more choice in what might have otherwise been restrictive, and it made things more pleasurable. But they were the main reasons why people invested in acquiring those extra, you know, in developing their food literacy. But that irrespective of how food literate somebody was, that its influence on diet quality or food security or whatever was really bound by the food supply and their early childhood experiences with food, which were then bound by the social determinants of health. So, for example, there was one lady that I spoke to who was 19 and living under a bridge, and she had come to Australia from New Zealand, so wasn't at the time eligible for any social security because she was like 15 or something when she came, 14 or 15. And then she'd been home, her mother had been in and out of, or had mental health issues, and so she had moved around a lot, and she had developed her food literacy a lot with an aunt who was a chef. So at the time that I was talking to her, she was living under a bridge at South Bank, and I asked her what she does when she gets a $20 food voucher and she doesn't know where the next one comes from. And she speaks, she just does the most perfect decision-making tree, where she talks about, she, you know, considers all the other options she has for food supply. She thinks about what she can get with a voucher that she can't get anywhere else. She thinks about what storage facilities she's got. She thinks about what cooking equipment she's got, because she's talking about the barbecue and the, and then she talks about what she can keep, what she can't, what she can spread over different types of meals, what she can't. And then finally she says, and I'd get this because I can share it and everybody likes it, because there's about 20 of us that live under the bridge and we're a bit of a community, so that when one of us gets a voucher, you know, like we, she talks, she hits on a textbook perfect definition of what you would tell someone to do. But that is no good to her in terms of her, well, I mean, it is some good to her, but it, there's a, that's not going to mean she has good diet quality in her life. And in contrast, I interviewed somebody who had just finished their master's. She'd had a nanny all her life, and she had never done anything in a kitchen at all until a couple of years before I interviewed her. And she was, you know, Googling stuff and buying recipe books and going to class. Like, she had the resources to experiment as much as she likes and fail and go and get something else to eat or try something and it not work and chuck it. Like, she could, like, so it was nothing to do with the fact that she did, you know, like, should we put this in the curriculum in primary schools or whatever? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was all around her,
but then was her resources. Diet quality good?
Yeah, it was great, because she had the space and she was earning good money. She'd got a job now because she was very employable.
But would you call her food literate after those 2 years? Like,
well, she could do quite a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Because she'd had 2 years to be able to experiment. And I think, like, going back to maybe some of the thing you touched on with, like, it's individualistic and why people might disregard it. Like, I know my personal experience with food education, because I guess that's where food literacy kind of fits in the, like, yeah, preventative health spectrum.
That's where it sits on conference programs.
Yeah. Is that, like, food education, that's how you would make someone food literate, I guess, from our professional standpoint. The work that we would do would be to educate people. And I've always felt, I've been always really hesitant, and anyone that knows me knows this, yeah, is because I find it really patronizing. And exactly what you just described with that woman under the bridge is the way that we conduct nutrition education is, this is how you cook something. You know, I've done cooking sessions where you go into somewhere and you've got, like, a, what are those, like, a wok thing, and you go, oh, if you just get some frozen vegetables and you just get this and you just do that and then you put it in the thing. And I just remember having people stare at me and I'm kind of going, I reckon they know this. I reckon they know exactly everything I'm talking about, and they're probably just here for a free feed. And then, but then there's been other occasions where we've cooked something as a group, but they chose the recipe.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, because they wanted to learn those skills. Yeah, and maybe that exactly was a difference.
Yeah,
and
I think it's all about how you go about doing it.
And I loved it.
Mm.
But how, yeah, I guess my question is, where does your work kind of fit in food literacy in the work that we would do as a profession? And how do we enact on that?
Yeah, look, I think it's like all community work, that you want to work closely with the community about what it is that they need. So I think there is a place, and this is kind of where it started with the department, is if people had identified that they wanted to develop those skills in that area, and often that was because a particular life event had happened. So they were looking after children for the first time, or they'd acquired a disease that they didn't, that was restricting what they could eat, or they were going to stable housing for the first time. There weren't a lot of places where, as an adult, you could go about acquiring those skills without paying for it, and in a way that was responsive to the circumstances that you were in. So I think it is really hard to tap into working out what people might be helpful for people. But that's a bit why the food literacy was meant to include all food that you're going to eat. So it might not really be that much about preparing food at all for you. It might be about what are some healthier choices in this food court, you know, like, so just a range of different things that you, that are whatever that person needs or that group of people.
It's really interesting. And so you've talked about, like, a little, you touched on like measuring food literacy, and so you've kind of developed it from where you started with your PhD, and you followed that work through to developing a measurement tool. I guess, like, what's the future of food literacy from your perspective? Where does it, where are you hoping to take it, or where do you think it needs to go as like a construct, I guess, within our profession?
The interest in developing a measure, and I'm so grateful to Courtney Thompson for progressing that work and for being so thorough in doing it and so patient with me, because I was so invested in it. It must have been awful for her to do a PhD with a supervisor that was just so precious about the whole thing. But I knew from my work in government that if you can't measure it, it doesn't kind of exist. So I knew we needed to find a measure for it. And then I was super precious about it's contextual. You're unlikely to be proficient in all aspects. So how do we create this measure that does all of that? And so we used item response theory and principal component analysis so that each item kind of sits a little bit independently. But that's then means your tools, like, it's a lot more work than to reduce the size of the tool. For us immediately, it is about getting this as short as we can and then looking for using that work to create like a set of indicator questions so that you can get a bit of a sense of where a population is going.
Like a short item measure.
Yeah. Like, so we're looking for like a nested set of measures. So if you're wanting to get a more fine grained sense, you're starting a program and you want to get more of a sense of where everybody's at, you might use a longer tool. If you're trying to just know, okay, which pockets of Queensland might we want to, or which particular socio-demographic groups or whatever, are there differences in? Do you want to just describe that? You might use a shorter version of the tool, but they kind of collapse into each other. And there's really health behavior questionnaires are really interesting at the moment because of the use of AI and using machine learning a bit to reduce the size of questionnaires so that the more you use them. So I'd like to understand that a little bit more.
Yeah.
That is beyond our professional capability, obviously, but I think that's where, because I think it particularly suits measuring something like this. So there's that, and then define, like getting consensus on the definition, which they're the two kind of big things I would like to see.
And with that measurement, like the way you described it, first of all, is that measurement tool available? Is it published?
The validation paper's published. And I think we want to just refine it a little bit more, but our intention is to have it publicly available on a website, but we just want to build the logic behind it and whatever so people can just use it easily.
Could people use that to inform like programs that they might want to do within their communities? Is that kind of what?
Yeah. So that's the idea.
Yeah. And then so instead of just kind of like what I described, that patronizing type of food education, it could be adapted to what the needs are of whatever community that they're targeting. Yeah, okay.
That's the concept.
Awesome. Mm. The question that I didn't ask, but I think it kind of follows on from like your journey through your career, is what's kind of come from doing this food literacy work? Like, I know that through that journey of when you started your PhD to where you are now, you've had some awesome opportunities kind of within that space.
Yeah, look, I, you know, as I said, I started this work doing a piece of work that was specific to the Queensland Department of Health, and I'd spent all these years writing briefs and things that all I could knew all about the stats of Queensland. And I deliberately chose a PhD supervisor. My third supervisor was from the UK. Never met him before, Martin Carraher, and I just heard him speak. And I cold called him to be my supervisor, and I'm so glad he agreed, because it, I thought, what a luxury, like partly because of my parents. And I knew my mum would just, my mum only went to grade seven. I knew she would just, this is just such a luxurious thing to be paid for your knowledge, isn't it? I thought, well, this is such a luxury to do your PhD. I'm going to go on a bit of an adventure. And so I was really pleased that he supervised my PhD, because it just automatically made me think internationally and connect me. But then, got the first conference I presented at was in the Netherlands, and it got a publisher approached me in the break and said, we think this is a field that might be worth there being a title on. And then that was a really good excuse to connect with people that I wanted to connect with and ask them to write chapters and kind of conceptualize out which parts that I thought they would like to write, because it typically reflected work they were doing that I found really interesting and I thought was relevant. And then the book resulted in, I didn't do a PhD by publication, as I wanted the experience of writing the thesis. I don't know if that's necessarily advice I'd give anyone else, but so I didn't have a lot of wasn't writing papers from my thesis. So the book was really good for that. And then the book, yeah, caught the eye of people in other countries. And I did also, I think because I of those earlier experiences of just going straight into ministers' offices and things. So I found this conference, this food studies conference taking place in Italy, and I put in for a symposium. And so there was a few of us from Australia that went. And I said, look, seeing we're in Italy, I'd been to an ICDEM conference in Rome and saw the FAO headquarters there. And I said, why don't we see if we can get a meeting with the nutrition education people? So I just emailed them. Amanda Lee knew someone from one of the teams, and I said, do you think you can kind of vaguely introduce me? And she did. And then that person knew the person who knew the person, kind of thing. I was with Danielle Galagos and Andrea Begley, and Andrea Begley's going, you have just got so much swagger, Helen. It's so bad. And I don't even know that I would do it now. I did it then, but at the time it didn't even feel that weird.
Well, maybe because you didn't have a reputation at that level that there was nothing to lose.
I don't actually remember thinking it was that big a deal. I just remember thinking, oh, the university's paying me all this money to go over to the other side of the world to speak for 15 minutes at a conference. I think I should try to set up as many other meetings as I can.
Yeah.
Because a few years later, I got invited to FAO Expert Committee on Nutrition in Schools that was in the UAE. And I literally thought it was a joke spam. because I thought, oh, I'm not an expert.
Why are they asking me?
What are they asking me? And so then I didn't even answer it straight away. And
oh
I
my gosh,
checked
so
with like Jan Reynolds, Tony Worsley, like all these other people that I thought were much bigger experts in that particular field than me, and said, did you get one of these? And they said no. And I'm like, I don't think so. And then a couple, I can't remember whether it was Tony or Jan, said, send it on to me, Helen. And they go, no, Helen, this is legit. So I got back in contact with them, and they said, yeah, we'd actually like you to speak. And it was because of the meeting.
Yeah, of course it was.
My call meeting, which of course when you think about it, those guys have just got like, how in the world would you ever find, like they're so far away from practice, aren't they?
Yes.
That yeah. Unless someone joins
shows
it all
up on their doorstep. I think this is your story, Helen. I think there's a trend emerging of you just calling people. This is how you got into the dietetics degree in the first place.
I mean that I hadn't quite identified for myself, but yeah.
And look where you are. Like, look where it got you.
Well, you can always say no. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like exactly. It gets you that far, and if you.
It's impressive. So what were you doing? You went to the UN in the UAE and you did school.
Yeah, so they. Well, so the food literacy frameworks, like my model, underpins several food and nutrition curriculums around the world. Like it's built around it.
That's amazing.
It is, isn't it?
That's incredible.
Nuts. And it's what's nuts is that it's slowed down a little. Oh, no, not so much. It doesn't slow down too much. But if somebody's interested in using it, I'll usually have a phone call, like a Zoom call with them. That's crazy how many, like all these different settings and places. So the book, the first mind-blowing part of the book one was the Italian Dietitians Association got in contact and I sort of said, sure, send me something, you know, some work that you've done first and I'll kind of – they were taking a while. So I emailed after a few weeks and said, listen, if you're trying to translate this into English and that's the holdup, send it to me in Italian because I grew up in an Italian household and I should be able to vaguely understand what your paper's about. And then they got crazy excited that someone could understand Italian. And so they sent the thing. And then they said, listen, I know we were going to have a Zoom call anyway. So we had this Zoom call and it was actually Skype and it was in that era of, you know, like the little spinning Skype thing. And so like as this thing's spinning, this is just such a life-changing moment, I can hear which is Stefania Verzozzi. She's from the Community and Public Health Nutrition's special interest group of the Italian Dietitians Association. And she's going, Elena, Elena. And I'm saying to her in Italian, I learnt my Italian at home, not at school. So I'm not going to be able to do this in Italian. And she's such a sassy Italian. She says, well, I learnt my English at school, not at home. So let's do this in Italian and let's see how far we get. So we have this Skype call in Italian and I'm like, finish it and I think, I can't believe I just got through that, like that I patched together enough. Then like 2 days later, she emails again. She goes, Helen, I've had another idea. Can we have another meeting? I'm like, yeah, sure. And we met again and she said, I'd like to invite you over as the keynote for the Italian Dietitians Conference.
Oh, my gosh. Did you have to do it in Italian?
And she said, but I'd like to do you to do it in Italian. And I said, oh, I don't think I could do that. And she said, well, I think you could. And it's funny because since when I got there, the others were like, they were like, I can't believe you're doing this in Italian. Only Stefania could convince someone to do this in Italian. So it was not even a cultural thing. It was her. And she said, well, I think you could. I'm happy to help you as much as you like. And so, and I did. And she kept adding other presentations to it. So the one for the actual keynote, you know, I wrote it out word for word and I practiced it heaps and I changed a lot of her words to words that I knew. You know, like there were some of her words that I didn't know. There weren't that many of them. But then there were a whole lot of words that I didn't know the social meaning of. So, you know, if you would say disadvantaged or poor or privileged, you know, like all those things have got a slightly different socially loaded term. So I worked with my cousins a bit. So I was set for that one, I thought. And then she kept adding these other presentations in. And I thought, right, so I had one that I was doing to the students of the University of Florence and another one that I was doing to the public health unit in Tuscany. And I'd written them out too. And the first one was to the public health unit and the director of the public health unit was a public health physician but he'd also been the mayor. So he was quite a very professional guy. And it was just, it's in super familiar looking public health unit meeting room, but there weren't that many people. And I thought I can't read this out word for word. I look like an idiot because there's not that many people
like it's
here.
Too formal like it's for it to,
yes.
Yeah.
So I had to just, I remember going to the bathrooms and going, well, you're just going to have to pull this off, Helen. And yeah, it worked. So, but the university one, I was collecting all the recording equipment to then go and present the lecture. And it's this, you know, like the building I was presenting in wasn't that old, but the university itself was. And, you know, my dad left and my mum was born in Australia, but her father and mother left under such impoverished circumstances, nowhere close to even going to school. Like, my uncle's illiterate. Like, it was wartime Italy. And I just thought, what a massive game changer migration is. Like, here I am one generation later.
Doing a keynote.
Yeah.
And going and presenting at a university.
Yeah.
Not just learning.
How crazy is that?
It is. It's insane.
And the presentation, I started it with, because I went to Italy once as a kid when I was 9, and then I went when I was backpacking at sort of 23. And then we went as a family when I was 45, I suppose. So I had pictures of kind of like the food, and like the one from when I was 9 was like my aunt and uncle had like that. We pumped the water. There were some rabbits that they had in these little cages that we killed, and then we just had wild greens. And then the second one, supermarkets were just coming, but we were still mainly buying our food from the markets. And then the most recent one, you just get to supermarkets. There's McDonald's in the town. There's regional clubs for those regions in Australia, right? And they're really largely centered around food. So I had this picture, particularly of my mum's region's Friuli, and they have, which is sort of near the Slovenian and Austrian border, and they have this like cauldron thing where they cook polenta, and it's called a fugarla, right? And it sits on a flame. And so the association for that region in Australia is called the Fugarla Furlang, right? the entire, like, that's how significant the food and the preparation of food is. Not that I think anyone else is identifying this, but that the literally that region's association is named after the cooking vessel. And their clubhouse is in the middle of nowhere. It's in Palara. Actually, they just closed down, so it's just not even there anymore. But it's our outskirts. Like, it's not even, you wouldn't even say it's close to Ipswich, because it's not close to anywhere. Like, it's somewhere between Ipswich and Brisbane, and where nobody's doing anything. And somebody's just tiled a toilet block, put up a couple of corrugated iron things, and they cook the polenta in the fogadla, and people go out there and it's stinking hot. And we're talking about this part that's near Austria where it's the Alps. It's a dish made for the cold. And so in the presentation, I opened the presentation with, you know, I'm really honored to be here, blah, 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 particularly because I'm the daughter of migrants. And I said, you know, I've been to Italy 3 times, and I showed the pictures from when I was 9 and whatever. And then I showed the pictures of this like fugarla furlang thing, and they were like, we had no idea this was going on the other side of the world.
Of course they wouldn't.
No, it was life-changing, because I, to be honest, I never thought that if you had said I could, like, my Italian's not that good. And the thing was more that I always felt like, and this is a bit where, you know, circle back to the theme of diversity in the profession, I've always thought my cultural background came into the way that I work. And the fact that someone read my work, had no idea of my cultural background, but it really resonated with them, and they saw their culture. So, well, they didn't necessarily, like, they didn't see their culture in it. They just thought this work really matched up with them.
But you kind of reflected on your culture as to how you got to exploring food literacy.
Yeah, but I didn't, but they don't know that. Do you know what I mean? Like, she saw this name, Helen Vidgen. Yeah. She didn't know that that person came from anywhere else, and it clicked with her, and I was like, oh, this is so cool.
Yeah, and so random that that's how it all happened. But sometimes they're the best.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where would you like to go? Like, what's kind of the future that you kind of hope to see? Because you've gone through, you've seen so much of it and seen it evolve so far and have kind of like peaks and troughs. And
I was all like, Now I've kind of gotten older. My daughters have finished school, and I always thought that once I'd finished school, I would be really ready to take off on my career and go into more senior roles. And now that that time's come, two things have happened. Now my mother's older and she's got care needs, and the gap between males and females is so great that to catch up, to have parity with males my age.
Like to be in a senior role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The gap's just too huge, and I don't have the huge burst of energy that I thought I would. So and maybe COVID added to all of that. So I was sort of a bit flat about that. And so I organized with two colleagues to go away on our own writing retreat for a couple of days at the beginning of December. And we went to the beach and we all did our separate things. And I was sort of reflecting on, well, what is it that I want to achieve between now and retiring? Like, what will be the things that I really want to stand out, and where do I need to be to do that? And I thought, actually, I think the most fulfilling thing for me to do is probably what I've done all along, which is to go with what I'm enjoying, and then the rest of it kind of takes care of itself. That's probably a bit of an arrogant thing to say, because it has to pay reasonably well.
You can't go literally
wherever you want. But I think that my interest has always been in food, and that's just got so many cool people that you meet and so many different connections and interesting things that do circle around. Like, opportunities come more often than you think they will. Like, you get really worked up about times when opportunities pass you by and you think that they're not coming again, but they usually do.
Or something better comes along.
Yeah.
It's so nice hearing you say that, because I think, and like, look, I'm not anywhere close to where you are in my career, but I've always said I want kind of two things in my job. I want to be interested in it and grow within it, but also I want to just enjoy it. And I think you're kind of saying that as well shows in the work that you've done. Like, you've achieved so much because you enjoy what you do. And if you try and go down this very straight path, you might not get the opportunity to do things, because
yeah, and I think
they'll just, you won't even see them as they come past you.
And you inherently have some criteria anyway. You know, we were talking before about whether or not ethically you go into some fields or you don't, or you feel professionally compromised. I feel like you always got some criteria. Like, I think for me, I always want to feel like I'm helping people somewhere, that my work somehow, like, I'm more motivated by that than profit, for example.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to see what kind of comes next with whatever you choose to do. It'll be fun. It'll be exciting. You'll knock on someone's door. But thank you so much for coming on the show, Helen. And I'm sure that we'll have you back on again at one point. So thanks for listening. We'll put some links in the show notes to various things that Helen brought up in the episode, including the food literacy research pieces, in case you're interested in anything that was talked about on the show today. If you're interested to hear more from Helen, go back and listen to part one of this interview. And remember, we're on Instagram or Twitter if you'd like to get in touch or ask any questions, and I've included the foodie's email in the show notes too. And if you do get a chance, share, subscribe, rate, and/or review the podcast to help us spread the word all about public health nutrition.